The Thomistic Institute's Rome Study Abroad program for undergraduates is unlike any other. Immerse yourself in a rich intellectual tradition and learn from top-tier Dominican professors and other Catholic intellectuals. Encounter the Eternal City and experience profound spiritual formation as you take excursions walking in the footsteps of Dominican saints through places like Siena, Florence, and more. The application deadline for the spring 2027 semester is August 1st. To learn more and apply, visit ThomisticInstitute.org/Rome.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
So I am so thrilled to be here. We've had a back and forth for about a year and a half. And I have to say, in the time of a year and a half, the topic got narrowed and broadened. So I'm actually not going to talk about natural law. I'm talking about nature. Because the last 9 months, we were talking about what is nature. I'm very much aware that UC San Diego is a science-awesome university. And so I've been I touch on this when I teach natural theology with seminarians as well as philosophical anthropology. So I'm talking about nature very generally. And then I'm going to talk a bit, I'll talk a little bit, but I'm more going to show you, this is why I wanted the PowerPoint, some images to help you think about exactly the question that you put, because I've been looking at like conference proceedings from when I was at Notre Dame, and scientists have conferences and ask precisely these questions. Are the laws of nature in nature, or do we impose them? And that's exactly the question that I want to arrive at. But most of my talk is just about classical Thomistic metaphysics, what is nature? But then I'm going to end by talking about this sort of modern problem that leads to why this is a source of crisis for scientists who are asking the questions, are we just making crap up and that's why, you know, our this accelerator isn't doing this or that? And I am heartened by the fact that those theoretical discussions are happening, but the last part of my talk, I'm going to suggest that classical Thomistic metaphysics offers a way to not put the questions to the side, but perhaps to breathe easy to some extent. So I'm going to get my water here. And so I'm going to do three things in this talk today, aware that we had our own technological difficulties, so I'll speed some things up. Some classical metaphysical content, just the idea of nature, like what the word means and what we understand by it in an everyday kind of way. Second, look more closely at St. Thomas Aquinas and appreciate the way that Thomas Aquinas, through the influence of Aristotle, Plato, and the Stoics, there's a lot of consonance with the ancient world and its view, but also with contemporary physics especially as well, not just physics. And then I'll bring in the idea of creation, what that means and how it jives with the idea of what nature is understood to be. And then, as I said, I'll end with the modern problematic of nature. So just these questions about otherness, alienation, are we imposing laws, are they in things? Why these questions even arise in the first place? Because when we talk about nature, we're always talking about like subject and object, the scientist looking at the thing before him or her. So it is about epistemology, how we know things. But more generally, we're also talking about experience. And that is something where the hypothetical method jives really well with Aristotle. Like there's a humility buried into the hypothetical method. We're just there looking at stuff. And what is going on in that experience before we even start to engage in properly scientific thinking? So, see, Thomas Aquinas, as just introduction, I'll signal you when I'm moving on because I like structure personally. He takes up a simple but profound truth from the classical tradition. There is a fittingness, and this is a beautiful Latin word, conveniencia. It's not convenience. It's things come together, they fit. There's a fittingness between man and nature, between me and the world. It's not necessarily a simple but that's why I use the word like fittingness instead of correspondence initially. So like nature is the matrix, the intelligent food of intelligent life. I'm going to come back to this. Aristotle says the mind is nothing until it thinks. So nature is like the content, the stuff of our thinking. There's no thought or even spiritual activity or life without what he calls a phantasm, an image. Without nature, human capacities become unnaturally ineffectual. And the classical way of describing this sounds, in a modern context, extremely insensitive. When someone is born without a particular capacity that doesn't function, like their sight or they're missing a limb, medieval thinkers will call this a sort of unnatural thing, but they don't mean that in a morally judgmental way. It's not moral at all. Disability is not a functional or essential failure, but the point is that, and as we see, people who are born without a faculty that most members of the species have, they tend to accommodate by higher functionality in other capacities. But we are born, we are meant to have a way of being at home in the world and drawing content from the world. The modern problematic that I'm going to get to, I'll get to this side here, but I'm going to put a bunch of images in front of you, and I'll say something about that in a minute. At the heart of the modern sort of problematic of nature and scientific thinking of nature, there's a deep anxiety. So as you said, for scientists, do the laws of nature arise from things understood, or are they artificial impositions that I put on just to make my science productive or to gain more research funding and so on and so forth? No problem, I'm used to it. In modern philosophy, the general consensus seems to be that the mind and the world are distinct, even alien to one another, and that when we approach nature, there's a constant threat of artificiality that we have to address. You see this anxiety in thinkers such as Rousseau and Hobbes. Think of, do you guys, I don't know if you're previous schooling, I don't think you have like a liberal arts or core content here, but some of you might have heard of Rousseau or Hobbes or even Thomas More. In the post-Renaissance era, usually when people are thinking about the establishing of social communes or new political communal forms, they'll posit a mythical sort of state of nature to ask the question, where does society come from? Do we just make this stuff up? Is culture, and Rousseau is really worried about this when he writes his work about education, is culture an artificial thing we come up with just to ruin everything that's beautiful in young children? You see this thread running through thinking about education from Dewey into the modern era, the 70s, there should be no walls in school, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the sense that what comes out of a human person is a barnacle that should be torn away because it's destructive in some way of what is truly natural. So is cultural tradition basically disfiguring? We'll get to this. Trust me, I'm not going to give you any answers, but this is why I'm going to put up, as we talk a bit about Aristotle and St. Thomas, images of art, because I'm going to use at the end of my talk one of several, he's not the only one, modern thinkers reflecting on this sense of alienation from nature that scientists and others have. And Hans-Georg Gadamer, he's a student of Heidegger, and like John Henry Newman, who you might have heard of, a lot of anxiety about an anthropology that tends to reductionism, that sees the ways that we assent to something. We say, this is true, or this seems true to me, that our criterion of certitude has become excessively narrow. And Gadamer proposes, a return to classical metaphysics, just get over your fear of anything metaphysical at all. But B, he says, we should return to these things like reflecting on how language works, especially looking at human development, even pre-linguistic language or conceptuality. But he also talks about the language of art as showing that the different ways that artists and each one of you just look at the world, there's a kind of correspondence that cries out this fittingness. This is San Diego. This is California. I'm looking at the light here is distinct. I have my experience. I belong here. I am at home here. So what Gadamer is doing, because he inherits from his teacher Heidegger an anxiety about anything transcendent, I think he gets over that by the end of his life. He's looking for a sense of a being at home with nature that is prior to scientific reflection that could lead one to be confident about scientific reflection. Okay, that's what I'm going to end with very briefly, but you're going to see pictures just flashing up in front of you, and I'm asking you to just look at them and think about, okay, this might be a picture or a diagram or a painting. Like, what is the painter saying? Like, what is this about this person's experience? Am I supposed to enter into it, or is it supposed to stay foreign to me? Like, what is the gaze? What is the look here? Oh, that's weird. Okay. So we're talking about nature. It's always great to begin with language etymology. So I'm speaking about what nature is, and nature is at its root. Nature comes from the term natus, to be born. And that's interesting. derives from the verb, the past participle of nashi, to be. So the first distinction I ask you to keep in mind, and a subsequent slide will remind you of this, for most ancient thinkers, especially thinkers who are doing an ancient version of natural science, the word nature is restricted to living things, because things that are living are marked by a capacity for birth, growth, and death, basically generation nutrition. The first distinction Aristotle handles in De Anima on the soul is things that move and don't move, because as you know, some things, their food comes to them and they don't have to move. Remember, an ancient version of the guild system, Aristotle is the son of a marine biologist, basically. So he's in the tide pools around Athens, looking at things floating around, asking, is this a plant or an animal? And that is often a really interesting question to ask. So life, living versus non-living. Rocks, of course, can be smashed up or reduced to sand, but this is an accidental change. So I'm giving you the Aristotelian language here. Things change due to extrinsic forces. With my daughter, a bit north of here on the beach, the striations, the colorations, you all know this. It's remarkable, the effect of water on rock over 500,000 years or so on and so forth. So it's an important distinction between living and non-living for science as for philosophy, and especially important for ethics. From another perspective, for the ancients, it really doesn't matter. That is, nature could include all of nature, whether it's living or not. So in this case, the idea of natus, of being born, just tells us that what is nature can be explained by causes. And this is where Aristotle really ends up. If you go the route of De Anima, psychology, ethics, the living, non-living distinction is really important. But what we're looking at more broadly, nature is just things that are subject to change, motion. You take a rock, however old it is, you can change it, you can smash it up. Okay, going back, you have the same origin in Greek thinking, and you go back to the word phusis, obviously the root of the word physics. Phusis means nature, and it also describes birth or things coming into being. But then we have a second distinction that comes into being, and you notice the different sort of subdivisions of phusis life here. Zae, zoological life, bios, biological life, suke, psychological life. Even if you have zero interest in Greek in itself, it's really interesting to track these words, for example, how the Greek terms operate in different passages of sacred scripture or different thinkers. If you read Aristotle's Metaphysics, you can get to book 12, and he says, the actuality of life is God. And that life is zoe. I have no idea why, but often zoe is animal or spiritual life. Or if you look at a interlinear version of 1 Corinthians 15, all about final things, which is very mysterious, we are also in a natural body, phusikos, and we are raised a spiritual body, psukikos. It's actually pneumatikos, I'm sorry. So the language matters as it relates to other texts, but the key thing is that phusis is the word that means life, and it could be divided into many different forms of life. But the second distinction I'm asking you to just keep in mind is that the nature of a thing, or the word nature, could describe the essential characteristics of a thing, as in when you say, what's the nature of X, of this person, Homo sapiens sapiens? So nature could be the essence of a thing. In that case, we're getting to language, scientific understanding, and the definition of her captures her essence and points to it intellectually. Okay, so there's many other disciplinary ways to approach nature, as I'm sure that you know, and I'm not really getting into this stuff, but in light of what interests personal or spiritual might have, you'll find readings about different schools of mystical naturalism, the Franciscan school of naturalism or the Irish school of naturalism. And they're not just metaphors or like vague postures of appreciation. They're really profound traditions, and they have buried within them a certain theological and often a scientific conception of what creation is and creation in relationship to revelation. So this is a bit of a sidebar that is, in my opinion, very important to keep in mind. So if you look at images like this, these are two images from Celtic manuscripts. Is there a way, by the way, with your computer to see the notes that I put here underneath? It's a matter of view. Thank you. Sorry to the editors of this. But you see here, I noticed the Book of Kells, and the reason I put this here, it might just be for the presenter view or something like that. That's fine. I don't care if other people see what I wrote there. Thank you very much. But like, this is about the year 800. You're good. You can sit down. This is Matthew 1:18. And you have to imagine like monks living in Ireland in pretty primitive conditions a long, long, long time ago. And like to illuminate one letter or one word or one verse in that way with gold leaf and all the decoration was often a work of several years for one monk. And it was an act of prayerful adoration for them. That's fine, that's great, I really don't care. That's fine. So what I pulled out here, I'm sorry for the quality of whether it's my computer or the room. Like what you see here is a lot of sort of naturalistic images. There are serpents, there's kelp, but here there's this tiny, so this is the Cairo, some of you might represent it, Matthew 1:18, when the word was made flesh. So the Chi and the Rho are the parts of the word Christ. But then there's just all this crazy nature stuff going around the actual image of the letter. It's a way of, I think it's just fun, frankly, for the monk in question or the monks in question illustrating it, but it's giving us a vision of like what the incarnation means. Like the Word of God, eternally begotten of the Father, is now like with us, with all the stuff, with the snakes and this and that. But then you have this little addition here. It's the otter who's eating a fish, the fish, of course, representing Christ. So it's a representation of the Eucharist in this artistic context. And then there's just an image there from I'm not usually going to talk about the pictures, actually, of the Cathedral of Reims in France. And you just see up there around the capitals at the top there, there's just beautiful carving of artistic life. And it doesn't need to be there. And it's not just a skilled mason or artist having fun. It's telling us something about what the place of worship is, how it brings together revelation and creation. Okay, so there are these schools of mystical naturalism, and I strongly encourage you to look into them. Just two examples. I have no image here to correspond to the Franciscan, but just consider my suggestion that looking at St. Francis and his prayers and what he is doing for the poor is more than just like what you see at the Home Depot, like birdbath, like the birdbath kind of Jesus thing. But look at that. Like this is a serious theological reflection on the totality of the incarnation. This is about, and this is inspired by a particular thinker, John Scotus Ara Eugena, a 9th century Irishman who actually saved civilization. And when he writes a work on the divisions of nature, he gives a fourfold distinction in the things that are, including the things that are not. And he actually includes God within nature. And it's just a beautiful meditation on scripture, very Aristotelian. So there are other traditions, and they're worth investigating, but we're going to stay, given the mission of the Institute and our interest today, more with the Aristotelian to mystic. So just take a look at the images and don't worry about the sidebar and anything that I have down. Nope, it did not work. Okay, thank you. Okay, so, and trust, no problem. Yep, just keep on going with the things. That's good. All right. So I said nature could be living versus non-living things, but it's more correct to say that's all things that constitute nature that are coming into being and passing away or are subject to change. Okay, so now we're going to move into some more philosophical stuff, though, and you're going to love this. So we have to understand some key terms as Aristotle considers what nature is. The most important is form, forma, in Latin. Form for Aristotle denotes a being, this thing, and a certain kind of thing falling under species. If it is a certain kind of thing, it is one thing and it has being, and that's nature. So that's the end of the talk, basically. But I'm going to talk a little bit more, so I ask you to bear with me here. With humans, saying that we are a form, Homo sapiens sapiens, is a bit more complicated. Philosophically speaking, Aristotle says that we have this form, a first actuality, but also like a second actuality, second perfection. Good news, we're works in progress. So we are capable of a certain kind of development perfection that transcends, even though it's based on like our natural capacities. If I ask you, what is a good dog? Probably you'll appeal to principles of domestication, a dog that doesn't run up at you and behave in a bad way. But those are extrinsic principles. When it comes to human perfection or formation, this is a more complicated process than just parenting a three-year-old, right? It's all the complexity of your life. What are the gifts given to me? What are the vices I struggle with, the virtues I've developed, et cetera, et cetera? I'm going to stay away from ethics, but just keep in mind with humans, what is natural is much more complicated. Okay, and that will lead to the other talk that you will have about natural law one of these days. But we have a given nature with a greater plasticity, I would say, than with animals or sea anemones. And this puts on us the freedom and the burden of realizing the nature that is given to us. So Aristotle, in Metaphysics, Book 4, he differentiates nature in terms of its origin and its constitution. So cause, where we come from, origin, you could think, yes, I got it, my parents. But it could be a little further or higher than that, further back than that. And then constitution, what we are actually made up of. So the origin, he says, is not nature in itself, but it's kind of a way in. So your mom and your dad have a wonderful date night, and you come to be, and all the angels rejoice. Human beings produce other human beings. Rabbits produce rabbits. At a scientific level, it is as simple as that. Constitution, though, he says, is nature properly speaking. What are you actually made up of? And he says, and this, I'm giving you sort of the progress of his thinking here. In fairness, Aristotle can be hard to study because by most accounts, likely we're reading lecture notes taken by his students that are compiled. He says, as to our constitution, this is our nature, and the first element of it is matter, hule. But more important than the matter, the stuff, even the types of cells, there is the essence. Okay, and then he kind of shifts in his argument and says the essence includes these three things: the matter, hule, the essence, or really the substance, usia, and the eidos, or the form. And he ends this treatment of Book 4 by returning to the origin. Yes, a nature is an essence or a form, but also we have to take into consideration the cause or the moving cause of a thing. So why I'm presenting this to you is, the reason I'm presenting this to you is that nature describes in a way, I apprehend you, I apprehend you. Like you're a unity, you're a this, you're a thing, I got it. But I might not understand you. Like I perceive, I don't understand. Aristotle uses the example familiar to us. I don't know if it ever gets hot enough around here like it does in Maryland in the summer. You know how it gets kind of wavy looking above the road. Way off in the distance, he asks, it looks like a tree, or maybe it's Joseph, I don't know, or Thomas, I don't know. And like the wavy thing, is it a man or is it a tree? Sort of. And his point is that if you're engaged in scientific understanding of how the heat arising from the asphalt is affecting your vision, you can make sense of the confusion. But you're just apprehending something, and then you have to undergo the process of understanding what exactly is it that I am seeing. So we perceive first, we don't necessarily understand, but either way, we're perceiving something. So the point here is that nature is embedded most fundamentally in form, insofar as form tells us what a thing is, but it's not obvious. We get it wrong, our perceptions are not always right. So getting to the true nature of a thing is actually an endpoint. Okay, so now the second distinction here becomes a bit more clear. That is constitution as essence and matter. We experience nature, he calls this in another work, the primary substance through its accidents. It looks like a person, it looks about this tall, it looks like it has hair, it could be branches, but I think it's hair. We perceive these accidents. And we move through them through approaching, through analysis. And what he's describing is a kind of movement where we receive data, that we bring it into us, and we go out and we assess, is there like a correspondence between my judgments and what I see in the world? So there's a kind of movement from without to within. We move deeper into the thing itself through distinctions and by reflection. At the same time, back to the principle, the mind being nothing until it thinks, we are, in thinking about the world, in doing science, engaged in a movement of self-formation. So we make things our own. I know that doesn't sound like really sexy or exciting if you're doing scientific research, but there are these moments when you're studying something and it's like a moment like, I get it. Like, I kind of understand this thing. It doesn't mean there's nothing left to be done. But think about the way that like young children development, even pre-verbally, enact the first principles of reason. Like you put your, I put my kids in front of something, and at some point they have three identical, like three circles and then a square, and there's just one point in time when they're just like difference. Like that's just different. Something like that is going on at a much more sophisticated level in your own studies, but it's a wonderful moment where you're not just looking at things as they appear, you actually get something. And you can really build on that. Okay, so I'm just gonna skip a little bit for the sake of time. So just two summary points in light of this terminology and distinctions about nature. Natures are just things that are, and because they are intelligible, but that is a process. It's a complicated process. But second, the ability to speak about nature involves the human intellect essentially. And again, this might seem obvious, but this second point drives the last part of my paper, both St. Thomas and the modern problematic. But I just want you to initially observe that what Aristotle is doing here is appreciating how nature is something that is real and has an integrity, but from the perspective of the observer entering into nature, it is a process that is complex and involves stages. Okay, and then Aristotle in book two sort of messes with what I just said and says natures are self-evident. He just means that it's obvious that they actually exist and that they have properties. So he considers two positions, that natures are underlying matter, or closer to Plato, that natures are just form. Okay, Homo sapiens sapiens, et cetera, et cetera. But with all due respect, none of you are the form of Homo sapiens sapiens. So we know Aristotle's gonna say that forms don't exist in themselves. But also, matter never exists without form. Like, you know, like cells that are designed to be cells to do a certain function in the liver have distinctive properties. The cells are going to do something very distinctive in the lower intestine have distinctive properties. So there's no such thing in reality as unformed matter, just general chaos. And then Aristotle considers the famous account of the four causes. Are you familiar with this? Like a moving cause, formal cause, and we don't need to talk about this, but the key thing is that in natural things, form, what a thing is and its purpose or its intention are one and the same. You drop an acorn in the soil in the right conditions, and lo and behold, you have an oak tree. This is how nature reveals a kind of order and rationality. Okay, and this is part of the beauty of nature as well. So, moving from physics to metaphysics, the basic constitution of nature rests with this formulation. Things are constituted of certain matter and form, and they always exist together. But this is the last thing in terms of abstract metaphysics I want you to appreciate. There's a third element here, and that is called stiresis or privation. You might be more familiar with the language of act and potency. Okay, potency or coming into being. This is really important because when you do an undergraduate class on Plato, or more likely in Aristotle, about these different causes, and you talk about matter and form, you read Aristotle and he says, you take a bunch of bronze and I'm an artist and I have an image and I try to apply this image to the bronze, and they're like, okay, form is shape. And that's a fine initial understanding what form is, but it's much closer to what DNA is. Form is like what a thing actually is and what it should be. But things are not what they ultimately should be, going back to the example of human development. The three-year-old who is doing incredible things in the development of his or her brain, they are still in potency. There's the stiresis, their privation. The acorn, as you know, like trees when they reproduce, there's ridiculous over-generosity. Tons of those things just die in the ground. But there's the potency there for those things to mature into full living members of that species. This is really important because I'm going to shift to talking about nature from a sort of ancient classical physics, metaphysics perspective, to talking about nature more as creation. And this potency, this dynamic thing in nature, is a very important piece of the ancient physical perspective because it ties it in a really beautiful way to what creation is. Because what creation means, again, etymologically, is that a thing has a cause, it comes into being. Okay, almost done with the metaphysics. I'm thinking about the time here. I was going to shift to Thomas and talk about creation from nothing, but I think I'm just going to skip this because of some of our technological difficulties, which is entirely on me. I will draw out, though, having said that, just a few brief comments here. We shift to St. Thomas talking about on the principles of nature. Sorry, double-sided copies. I have no idea what's going on here. Ah, amazing. Okay, I can come back to creation ex nihilo if you want to. Because the fundamental insight here about nature that allows us to move with scientific integrity from the perspective of physics, metaphysics, to a more theological perspective is that element of privation or potency, that things come into being. They have a source. And this is not a great mystery to us who actually look at nature. And with the debate about creation ex nihilo that is so interesting in the Middle Ages is that St. Thomas actually breaks from the context of what most medieval thinkers think. In his time, the advent of new scientific texts, mostly Aristotle, but other texts coming through the Arabic-speaking peoples, coming up through Spain into the great universities, they see science as a threat to revelation. Because you open the Bible and you read Genesis, that says in the beginning. Well, there's a beginning of time. But it seems to Aristotle that based on evident scientific data that nothing comes from nothing and nothing ever could. So this proposes the hypothesis of an eternal world. So it seems like the best option is to have like a column in your mental life, and that's where I'm a believer, and there's a beginning. On the one hand, the other hand, there's another column. And there is no beginning, and I'm actually a scientific person, and I love the eternity of the world. And St. Thomas disagrees with Alexander of Hales, and in a really subtle way with Bonaventure, he goes with his teacher, Albert the Great, by saying, yeah, looking at the world, seeing that creation by its nature is everything that comes into being has a cause. It's not necessary that anything exists at all. It seems to me that Aristotle is basically right. But there is no way of, there's no necessity to this conclusion. That is, if there is a creation of time, we could not prove it scientifically. And we're not really bound to hold it from a scientific basis. People like Bonaventure are concerned that this proposes a conflict between science and revelation. Thomas says, if God is good, if God is wise, and he's a creator, there can be no conflict between scientific data and revelation. He just says that science proposes this, and I say, here's 18 arguments for why creation out of nothing is highly probable, but it is not scientifically demonstrable. It's a matter of faith. I'm happy to come back to you. It's a complicated thing, but it's a really interesting test case that resonates with the teachings of the last three popes about the relationship between faith and reason. These are not like two worlds that have nothing to do with each other, but they are different worlds. But they can't conflict fundamentally, because if they conflict, then that would be asking too much of a smart scientist or a student of science like all of you are. Okay, so just shifting then to St. Thomas Aquinas. So I mentioned just a little bit back that this principle of the mind is nothing until it thinks. Moving into a more medieval perspective here, it's fair to say that Aristotle and Thomas are perfectly fine with a strong, rigorous sense of our scientific capacity to know the world. On the other hand, as St. Thomas Aquinas cites several times, Aristotle also says, we hardly understand natural things as it is. He says several times, matter is a great mystery. Any of you study matter or energy will know that is entirely true. The point there, though, is, again, that moment of humility that allows for stasis or privation, not just of human understanding, but of how nature actually works. So I describe the experience and articulation of nature as a kind of movement, a going out, and the mind being conformed to nature and then returning. So intellectual potency, according to St. Thomas and Aristotle, is a kind of natural infinitude. Your mind is open to all being. So that tree, and there are just remarkable trees here in California, that tree, that pine tree, is out there. It becomes actually perceivable as it is actually being perceived. So with a fairly sophisticated understanding of optics for Aristotle, he says there's a different essence. The tree is out there. it's different, and then there's me. But essentially, the seeing of the tree is the same act. I see the tree. So for St. Thomas, as for Aristotle, color is not a mental construct. This color is caused by the thing in nature and has a lot to do with that principle of activation. So if it's a humid day and that affects the light in a certain way, the green will have a different shade and so on and so forth. He's very much aware of that. But the actualization of the tree in respect of vision actually being seen only occurs in relation to the seeing subject. So things in the world, that is nature, exists in its integrity, but we apprehend things and their distinctive properties. Considering them as beings in the world, we start to think about a thing, like defining a thing. Is it this kind of tree, that kind of, you know how scientific taxonomy works, distinction and relation. We start to think about the being of a thing, what scholars of Aristotle would call being qua being. And through this kind of analysis, we're able to say, this is true. That tree is a member of this species, species X, and a really nice member at that. So Thomas's point, and this goes back to an early work on first principles, Thomas's point is to say the proper object of the intellect that we consider is being, but the intellectual affirmation that is ordered to being is truth. And of course, as is typical with philosophy, there's many ways to define truth, but the most basic and formal way is one of correspondence. Or you might have heard this phrase, the adequation of the intellect to a thing in itself. Now, it might sound like I'm looking at this wonderful pine tree and I have a phantasm and an image and I'm doing scientific taxonomy, and there's a kind of correspondence. But Aristotle is, even though he's using metaphors, is much stronger than this. He says, the mind is nothing until it thinks. It's kind of like a wax tablet. And when I understand something, there's something impressed upon it. And as he understands memory and all of its complexity, and Augustine develops this with great sophistication from Aristotle, things are impressed upon our memory with a great deal of sophistication according to the distinctions and the properties. But when it's there, it's kind of me. It's there as a concept, not just an image in my imagination, my memory. Okay, so this adequation of the intellect to the thing is how the mind really corresponds to, and we correspond to nature. So St. Thomas, as a second, really last point about St. Thomas, clarifies this in De Veritate, the questions on truth. Truth, St. Thomas says, is first in our intellect and not in things. We don't say a tree is true. We say, my judgment, that tree is a member of this species. That is a true judgment or false. It's in the mind first and not in things. But then he goes on and says something really interesting. Let's think about different ways of knowing. There's speculative, contemplative knowing, and practical knowing, or like craftsman knowing. He says, if we're talking about contemplative, which is more scientific knowing, then we would say my intellect is measured and formed by the thing in itself. And that seems straightforward. I have a perception, I make judgments. But Thomas goes on and he says, well, what if we're looking at it from a practical or craftsman perspective? And I have to say, this, I've struggled with this for a long time because I've used a wonderful book by Joseph Pieper called The Silence of St. Thomas. In the second essay, he says, the Thomistic principle of all principles is creation. Creation is the center of everything. Creation is good. What is creation? You have to understand this. And he says early on this essay that creation is, he says that nature in itself, creation as nature, is intelligible to us because it's being creatively thought. I don't think I've understood that clearly for a long time. I'm just admitting that to you. But working through the De Veritate, it makes a lot more sense to me right now. So when you study St. Thomas, like Summa Contra Gentiles, book one, he talks about divine wisdom, divine order. And in order to keep God like separate from the progression of things in the order of time, he talks about God in a way that gives us a picture of God as a silent contemplative. Like God creates and then he steps back and he sees everything in eternity, no time, just sees it all in a quiet, calm way. Nothing affects him. This upholds the idea of divine perfection and divine immutability. But then he moves on in considering divine knowledge and asks the question, does God know particular things? Does God actually number the hairs of my head? And you can imagine the payoff of this spiritually, theologically is huge. And he says, okay, let's just think about God a different way. You think, what does a good CEO look like? Catholic subsidiarity. You find good people and you delegate. A good CEO doesn't go to the mailroom and say, no, this is how you sort, if you sort mail anymore, I have no idea. Reference is much too old. So he wants to keep God apart from the mess, as it were, of nature and its temporal order. But as he goes on, asks a question, particularly as he says, no, God can know things and interact with creation directly or indirectly, like through intermediaries, like natural causes, through secondary causes, like the laws of nature, or secondary causes like intercessory prayers, all sorts of things. But even if God's knowledge of things is mediated by things like that, God is not to be seen like a CEO. He's to be seen as a craftsman. He has dirt under his nails. He is in the muck, involved with everything. So my point about De Veritate 1, especially 1-2, is that he says, if we look at practical knowledge, our mind is not formed by anything. We have to think of God more as an artist. Things are formed by our mind. Okay, like my mind becomes the measure of nature. Okay, it's just a really interesting shift in his thinking. And it makes a lot of sense of how we can think about our mind as adequated or corresponded to nature, not as something alien to it. One scholar's last name is Dobie, says that what Pieper is getting at here by saying that nature is intelligible because God is creatively thinking it, is that what we are doing as students of science or just looking at the world is we have to consider that nature is a kind of screen or a kind of image or symbolic thing through which we perceive divine order. But really what we're looking at is nature. But if God's wisdom and order were withdrawn from nature, it wouldn't make any sense to us. We would just have our five senses and a bunch of stimuli coming into us, and it wouldn't make any sense anymore. So the point here is to avoid the, is it me first or nature first, where the laws come from, and say, it's not that. Nature has its integrity, but we really can't talk about nature in an interesting way until we're connected with it, or better, realizing the interconnection that we have with it. I'll come back to this. So I think that this is what Thomas is getting at in the De Veritate. All right, I'm going to shift very quickly. What are we doing for time here? Okay, thank you very much. Okay, I'm just going to give you one quotation from De Veritate 1-2. The natural thing is constituted. Nature exists between two intellects. It is true insofar as it is adequate to both. With respect to the divine intellect, it is said to be true insofar as it fulfills the end to which it is ordered, what God wills through his wisdom. It is said to be true according to its adequation to the human intellect, insofar as it is in its nature, that is, nature is born, to form from itself a true judgment. So in a way, nature really does exist for us to see it, to perceive it, and to enjoy it. Do we perceive God through it? Absolutely. But we can also just rest with that perspective, that experience, that enjoyment. So the divine mind, Thomas goes on to say, measures the human mind is measured directly by nature and indirectly by God. Nature is a kind of incarnational mediator of the human intellect. And yes, humans are arguably most like God in their creativity. Nature is going to be true regardless of my human perspective. Still, nature, as I said, would be nothing without the order that drives the divine mind. So to conclude, nature is what is, beings living and not, material, spiritual, in a special way living things, but all that is born, all that is created, creata. Nature appears in its formality, first through its accidents, its characteristics, and then through these accidents we come to define the essence of a thing and come to its truth. It is also clear that nature as other is the only thing that makes human activity possible. If a child is born and has no sense data, they are not going to become a human being. At sort of micro levels, we know this from some studies of unusual situations of human development. This is like 15 years old, but children born in context of like orphanages where like children, if they don't have like that interaction with different kinds of like human facial expressions and this and that, their brain is not formed in a proper kind of way. But imagine being born with no stimulus whatsoever, okay? Nature is the only thing that makes humanity, human activity, never mind scientific activity, possible. We are petted beings and we are fittingly made for nature. And at every moment of the day, the joy, the clarity of the sunshine, the refreshment we have in life-giving water, at the intellectual level, there is simply no mind, no activity in the absence of nature. And I'm not going to get into this, but speaking of St. Augustine, when he talks about beauty in an early work, De Vera Religione, he talks about nature in terms of form, and he uses a different Latin term than forma, sometimes species. It looks like species. And it means form, but it also means appearance, likeness, and beauty. And he says the fact that things appear to us with a kind of redolence, a kind of luminosity, when we perceive things as they are, we see that they are complete in themselves. They are finished. They are nature. But at the same time, they're not finished. And that's what the luminescence I'm suggesting is speaking of. Because everything tends to some greater end. And Augustine really expands the sense of nature as the order, the beauty of the whole. And this jives in an obvious way with contemporary science, like the fact that that everything tends to a kind of balance, even through a kind of destruction or predation. And for Augustine, as for St. Thomas, the greater intelligibility of nature and the greater beauty of nature is that order of the whole, that perfection of the whole. So Thomas will describe the beauty of the whole in terms of gradations or diversity. And this is a more perfect manifestation of the wisdom of the divine mind at work in nature. Okay, I'm going to come to an end. I mentioned this modern problematic. I'm just going to show you a couple more slides. And in a few minutes, I'll tell you why I'm showing you these things, not just because it's fun. I don't know if any of you know where this is, but these are some mosaics from Ravenna in a part of Italy that was briefly the center of the empire and strongly influenced by what would become, but also was directly influenced by artistic influence from the East that, you know, tend to resist human representation. Muslim art. Like if you see, I saw some mosques in Morocco where the mosaic representations of nature are just exquisite here. And there's a lot of animals here. So you might see a very predictable scene like a saint or the crucifixion, and then there's a bunch of birds and a bunch of animals. And again, this is a statement about not just the iconographic power of nature, but the sense in which that order, the beauty of the whole, is a resplendent reflection of creation, of God at work in things. All right, but I'm going to finish with this modern problem, and doing intellectual history is such a temptation. Speaking very loosely, it's just a lot of fun to point the finger at the bad guys, but it's so hard just in the work that I've done, especially for my classes, looking at the emergence of the disciplines of sociology, psychology, but getting at some of the really key, fascinating modern thinkers like Locke, Hobbes, and Smith. They're trying to understand the human person, like what drives us, what really gets us going. And after a time, you see more and more critics considering that the human person has become something completely vacant. And what I'm suggesting to you in closing is that the real problem in a modern context is that we have just simply accepted and decided to live with an assumption that we're alienated from nature, rather than just accepting that the nature as we see it around us is fitting, it's made for us, and that there isn't really quite such a problem as we think there is. So I'm just going to conclude here by showing you how the medieval, and talking about how the medieval and ancient assumption that nature is intelligible and that it is a home to the intelligent observer, how this is subject to many difficult questions in the modern era, returning us to the refreshment of ancient and Thomistic wisdom, truly. Okay, I'm just going to stay. I'll just go here. So the tension between us and nature arises, as I've said, from a set of assumptions, but one key assumption is at work. It is the Cartesian assumption that nature has to be bracketed. That's a later philosophical term, bracketed, so that we can be certain. We can have proper scientific certitude. So in a way, external data is the problem. What I was saying with Aristotle's example of seeing somebody on a road and it's hot and it's wiggly and like, is that a person or a tree? Or the moon off in the horizon, it looks like it's about maybe like, I don't know, centimeter and a half diameter. Aristotle says, yeah, those are perceptions, but then you have to examine them. We can account for the limitations of sense perception. We do not need to come to the conclusion that sense is in its very essence deceptive. The problem, by many different routes, is how we come to be in a place where the mind is a self-enclosed world. The cost of this is significant. It's diagnosed by many thinkers. I mentioned John Henry Newman, but there are interesting philosophers of science like Kuhn, and I can share references to some of the people I was alluding to before, reflecting about scientific deliberation, but also of theology and science, for example, Amos Funkelstein. I'm just going to talk briefly about one thinker, Hans-Georg Gadamer. He's a student of Heidegger. In his mature viewpoint, he's writing late into the 20th century. He doesn't overcome Heidegger's fear of God, basically, of anything theological. But he's getting there because he's reading Aristotle and Plato and metaphysics and thinking, okay, this just makes a whole lot of sense. So mid-career, he starts to rebel against this assumption of a dichotomy between mind and nature, or creature and creature. And he's reading contemporary phenomenologists, students of Husserl, the great slogan, back to the things themselves. And you read some of these treatises by phenomenologists, and they're brilliant. They're trying to overcome this alienation between the mind and the world. And they're these very detailed analytical methodological considerations of how I look at this thing, like what's behind it, how am I sort of moving around it with my sense combined with my imagination. And he's just frustrated. This is not enough. So in an essay from 1960, Gadamer addresses these two common philosophical terms. I don't think I put these up here. I'm just going to keep moving my slides along here. The nature of things, very common philosophical thinking in the 20th century, nature of things and things speak for themselves. So the word things is translated by Sache in German and Ding, like Ding. And everyone handles them as though they're self-evident and need no explanation. And he says, that's just garbage. The self-evidence of things is just not true. And he says, behind it is this long tradition, and he does dump a lot of garbage on Kant, but he's more concerned with people like Hobbes and Bacon, who see nature as a kind of mechanistic thing, and even a contemporary philosopher, a friend of his, Carl Livet, who says, nature is totally numb to us. Nature doesn't care. It is basically dead matter that we work with. You can see in that language a rising anxiety about a sort of technological mindset. And Heidegger is concerned about this too, that we just see matter as a bunch of dead things, and we are the dominating overlords, and we can do whatever we want with it. So that is a piece of this here. But just getting back to the human view of nature, there is this assumption that things are to be used, a mechanistic view of the changeableness of nature, that is, nature is dead, is a raw matter for understanding and product and production. And he says there's no critique in all of this assumption of the otherness of nature, no attempt to even see ourselves as a part of nature. So he does recall from Heidegger sympathetically when Heidegger says we have to wake up and see that things are not just to be used, but remember that there is being and things as they are. And he finds a new idealism, that is, he sees this as an outcome of a sort of Hegelian idealism that deepens this alienation, a total determination of an object by cognition. I'll explain this in a minute. Seeing progress, not just scientific progress, but human history as an infinite task of determination. The endlessness of the continuum of experience underlying a kind of vicious subjectivism. So back to Carl Livet, the natural world is indifferent. It doesn't care about us. And we experience this, right? It doesn't care about us. The true assumption behind the divide is that of human subjectivity as well. So that is the anthropological problem he sees dominating these modern scientific anxieties. My will is the determinator of the laws of nature. He says classical metaphysics offers a better way. He's anxious to avoid transcendence, as I said, because he wants to come up with a way to get around this objectification of nature without going straight to God. But I think we can work with that because he says, back to classical metaphysics, Aristotle and Thomas understand the mind, truth, as conformity of the mind to a thing. And our mind could only conform to something if there was some kind of correspondence that pre-exists our articulation. So he's trying to get to a sense of nature as having privation or stasis within it. And yeah, you could use Joseph Pieper's term, even a sense of mystery. Aristotle says, we don't understand matter, and correct me if I'm wrong, you guys don't understand what matter is. You have a major paradigm shift about every 10 to 15 years. And I'll explain why I'm showing you a series of pictures of Cézanne developing from a post-impressionist to a post-post-impressionist thing, becoming much more geometric and mathematical, because he's looking at the same darn thing over the course of about 80 artistic representations, but he's just looking at the same thing. And if he wasn't sitting in his house in Aix-de-Provence looking at this thing, talking with it over a period of time, with existing cultural assumptions and a certain kind of light, he wouldn't be able to engage in a kind of artistic version of scientific analysis. And this is what Gadamer talks about in this beautiful essay. He talks about language and the way Wittgenstein understands language as something that has a kind of autonomous meaning before it. Okay, you teach a child a word and you point to something, but the word has its own life, its own meaning in regard to the pointing. It doesn't exhaust the meaning of a thing. Language is completely cultural. It is a construct, but it has a kind of meaning and integrity in itself in this context. It has a kind of pointing. So Gadamer says that the language of things expresses a primordial correspondence of soul and being that is exhibited. It's a finite truth, and our consciousness can come to it. And he develops this in terms of language and artistic symbolism. All these things that are forms of representation are finite embodied spirits. And when he says finite, he's not saying no to God. He's saying, this is Cézanne at this time, at this point in his career, and he's interested in geometric forms that are in nature. Right? I remember my mom in art school a million years ago saying, there are no straight lines in nature, and you hear that all the time. But he's saying, I don't think that that's a true way of looking at nature. I see geometry at work everywhere, not just in the artificial stuff. He's corresponding with Émile Zola, who's bemoaning the effect of industrialism in the French, in French urban centers. So often these pictures have like the train track. I'll show you some of these going through. And this is obviously photographs of the same thing by way of reference, but this in an early one, in many of these pictures, it's clear the train track doesn't belong. He accepts it, but it doesn't belong there. And in these, this is like the very latest representations. It's like so much movement, and there are not different worlds. Like the world of human creativity, of productivity, yes, it's different, but it's drawing from nature. I'll just conclude and then just say a few more things about these pictures if you're interested in them. So even though Gadamer is trying to kind of avoid the theological move, what he's saying about art and about language and the way that they express this correspondence, this creatureliness in itself, I think is extremely interesting. And the fact that he sees classical metaphysics as the way to just, not just overcome, but set aside this sense of alienation. And just to end here with a citation that's really important for Gadamer from German poet Hölderlin, who says that this poetic sense, this consciousness, and I think this has to speak to the sensibility of the scientist as well, looking at things with a sense of awe as per the Easter Monday collect. He says, the soul and the world address each other as finite beings, as in the here and now, in the finitude of nature and its structure as creature. There's a profound consonance there with that Thomistic sense of correspondence, but also that Aristotelian Thomistic sense that nature within itself is something poorly understood and should humbly set us in the right posture to understand it better, to see both its order and its beauty, its nature as reflective of divine wisdom. I'll just stop there and say some more about the paintings, maybe in the question period. So thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.